So I remember the first Sunday Brian came to church, because we had a Gracie was in nursery, and there was a, I went back there because the nursery workers were back there and back there and back there. This is like 30 minutes afterwards. So I went back to try to rescue the nursery workers, see what's going on. And it was the Boulwares were watching Gracie, because I was talking to Brian, and I went back to apologize to the Boulwares for keeping them back there so long, and they said, stay as long as you want. We're happy to serve when God is moving. So how do you get better at anything? How do you grow in a skill? You say, well, Terry, you practice. So what happens if you get lots of practice without any criticism? You say, well, no one needs criticism. Actually, you do, because without criticism, you develop bad habits. So, for instance, my wife teaches piano. She has for a long time, and I've heard several million piano practices going on in the background. That's an exaggeration, but it's a perceptual experience. It seemed like that. And if you don't get criticism from a more experienced pianist, you become a well-practiced bad piano player. You develop bad habits. And you can say, well, I hate criticism. I want a kind, helpful teacher, not a critic. My wife is a very kind, helpful teacher, but teaching by default is going to offer critique. That's right, that's wrong. Teaching is criticism. And we need to reframe what criticism or critique is. The music or the art critic doesn't just say what's bad about the arts. They're skilled, supposedly skilled, in knowing what's good as well. And we very often conflate or combine criticism of our ideas, our attitudes, and our actions as an attack on who we are as people. So instead of hearing that was a wrong note, we hear you're stupid. Instead of that idea is wrong, that attitude is unhealthy, or that action is sinful, we hear you're worthless, you're pathetic, you're a loser. So criticism or critique of our ideas, attitudes, and actions is necessary if we're going to grow and thrive. But sometimes, and maybe often, critique is perceived as being something bad, a personal attack. And whenever we feel attacked, we often respond with fight, flight, or freeze. And I understand there are times when you are being attacked by others, either literally or in words. But if we're to become wise, and certainly if we're going to become wise decision makers, we can't conflate criticism of our ideas, attitudes, and actions with personal attack. They're not the same thing. And this reaction to criticism is common, but it's unhelpful, and something that Proverbs tells us we can grow out of if we're going to become wise. This year, we're looking at Proverbs, wise living. This month, wise decisions. And today, the vital importance of listening to others, of learning to thrive in critique in order to grow in wisdom, specifically to become better, wiser deciders. So listen to Proverbs 9, verses 7 and 9. Whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes a wicked man incurs abuse. Do not rebuke a mocker or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. Instruct a wise man and he'll be wiser still. Teach a righteous man and he will add to his learning. So wisdom's primary teaching method is to critique our ideas, attitudes, and actions. And we don't naturally love to be corrected, but we can grow in wisdom and in corresponding love for what it takes to be wise, which is correction. And the further one goes into folly, you find this in Proverbs, the less they're going to put up with critique. The further one goes into wisdom, the more they will learn to embrace critique. And throughout Proverbs, the ability to hear and respond in an honest way to criticism is crucial to personal growth. There's no growth in wisdom without acknowledgement of our need to grow and change. And if you don't listen to criticism, then you're going to repeat the same mistakes over and over. So wisdom is, at the default level, being humble enough to know you're not perfect, to be willing to hear criticism. And in fact, the wise man, it says, or the wise woman, will learn to love correction, love you for giving it, because it keeps him from making the same mistake over and over. And this is not just for the novice. This is not just for the beginner or the child. It says if you teach a wise man or wise woman, he or she will become wiser still. We don't stop growing. On the other hand, the fool, if you point out an imperfection, they'll hate you for it. They don't grow. In Proverbs, folly is a scale, and there's several Hebrew words used that are often translated fool. Sometimes they're given nuances like mocker. But the scale, on the one end of the scale, is the simple or the simpleton. On the other end, the far end, is the mocker. And then there's various levels of fools in between. The simpleton is just someone who is just hasn't been around long enough. And they can stay simple and move into full-blown folly, or they can become wise. The mocker is someone who's embraced folly. Matter of fact, they embrace it so much that they will mock that which is good. They will mock wisdom. And if you offer advice to the mocker, you're going to get insulted. In fact, in extreme cases, you might be physically attacked. I watched a video recently of a man who came to the defense, not physically, but just verbally came to the defense of a child who was being verbally attacked and physically threatened by two grown women. And the response to that critique was one of the women punched the guy in the face. Fortunately, she was caught and arrested for her folly. In Proverbs, the fool is learning or has learned to hate wisdom, and so they don't see correction as something valuable or useful. In what is called the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "Don't give to dogs what is sacred. Don't throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces." So there were some domestic dogs and pets at the time, but there were large numbers of wild, feral, dangerous pack animals. And Jesus is not saying that some people are worthless animals and not worthy of you wasting your words on. This is a statement about a person's heart and their perception of what's valuable. Do you know that sharks, bears, snakes, and alligators combined kill about 9 people a year in the U.S.? Cows kill 22 people a year. So fear the cow and not the shark. But cows, fortunately, are not roaming the prairies looking for human victims. The high number is because people work around cows a lot. A larger number of people are killed by dogs and pigs each year. And unlike killer cows, who aren't known to consume their victims, dogs and pigs sometimes will. Now, if you offered a dog or a pig something of real value to you, here is an expensive piece of jewelry, here's keys to a brand new car, they may sniff them, but they'll ignore them. They hold no value for them. They can't hold value for them. They're animals. What is the pig supposed to do with a pearl? Give a pig or a dog a rotting piece of meat. That's a real treasure. And so Jesus is not here saying treat people like animals. He's commenting on the heart and the mind, the spiritual condition of a person who's not fully alive to God. Sacred things, valuable things, are worthless to them. And our response to criticism, to advice, to counsel, tells us something about the status of our spiritual maturity. Do we see it as a gift, as valuable, as a treasure? And in Proverbs, the wise are shown to be wise by their response to this treasure of criticism. And so the question for each of us, are we on the path to wisdom as revealed by how we respond to criticism? I read recently about an international Christian leader who lost his position for several reasons, but key among them was he would not listen to anybody. He was gifted, he was effective, but if someone offered him criticism of any kind, he would verbally abuse them. My first thought was, this man is gifted, he's famous, but he's not mature. My second thought was, God help me. Help me love critique. Now, I've told the story of Paul Kimigis many times, but it bears repeating today because it directly speaks to this point. I first met Paul in 1986. He went to be with the Lord several years ago. Paul was a large, loud man. He took over every room he went into. He just filled the room with his presence. And he would get in your face. He lacked situational awareness. He would completely agree with this if you heard it right now. He didn't end this way, but he would get about this close to you and talk loud and long. And so I got to where we had these meetings together in this room with people, and I would find a pillar and try to keep the pillar between me and Paul as much as possible. After a number of months of avoiding Paul, but also realizing he was a good person, my brother, also named Paul, and I took him to dinner. And we didn't know Paul well, didn't know how he would respond to critique. And we sat across the table at Pizza Hut downtown, and I said, "Paul, you intimidate people. I think you love people, but your approach makes him want to run. You have to change if you want to have relationship." And he looked at me quietly for a moment, and then tears came down his face, and he said, finally. He did like this. He said, finally. And the finally turned out to be, finally someone who will tell me the truth, help me change. We became brothers, the closest of friends. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. Next week, we'll address getting counsel in specific decisions, and then we'll bring this month to a conclusion. But today, I want to finish with some applications for learning to love criticism. The first, this is something, if you've been around, you've heard before. Call it black wall, white wall. Trust your friends when you most need them. And white wall, black wall is a sort of mental hook for listening to others and trusting them when you most need to. And the idea is this. If I'm looking at the wall and it's clearly a white wall in my mind, and I have trusted friends who say, Terry, that wall is not white, it's black, who am I going to trust? Am I going to trust my senses, my perceptions? This is not absolute. I'm not saying your friends can't be wrong, but it is a powerful way to move through life and connect a community. I'm reading a book called Slow Brain, Fast Brain by a Nobel economist and psychologist named Daniel Kahneman. And he demonstrates really in fascinating and convincing fashion that we are better at seeing errors in thinking in others than we are in ourselves. Yet, we trust ourselves implicitly, even when we're operating largely out of emotions or habits, not just facts. He gave an illustration. I'll talk a little bit more next week. But they did a study of judges on parole board in Israel. He's a Jewish man from Israel. And they found out that when you get low on calories, on glucose, then your central nervous system, your processor, draws a lot of amps, for lack of a better word. And so they studied the number of people who were paroled at different times of the day. The number when these judges had just had breakfast or lunch, about 60%. The closer it got to noon, it got lower and lower to where it went to a zero right before noon. You can't tell me all the cases were zeros at that point, but their processes were slowing down and their brains reverted to their default part of their brain. And so all of us, every one of us, are prone to making decisions based on chemical things going on in our bodies, our preferences, emotions. If you say, not me, Terry, I put Spock to shame. I approach decisions logically. Well, you just proved my point. You trust yourself more than you should. And so we want to build relationships and learn to trust people, especially during times when we're convinced something might be true. I've seen people make terrible choices because they refuse to trust the wise people around them. I've not seen the reverse to be true. And often we want accountability until we really need it. And when we really need correction or direction is when we're committed emotionally to some position. And we need to listen well. Paul went through a terrible time in his life. He had been rejected and abused as a child and young man. And so when his marriage fell apart, he was in a terrible place emotionally, and he contemplated ending his life. He would come sit on our couch for hours, and we would just let him sit there and go about our business. And one day, he wasn't thinking clearly. His mind was clouded by sorrow, and he told me a decision he was contemplating, not suicide that day. That was a different day. But he told me a decision he was thinking about making. It wasn't going to be a wise decision at that point. I just said, well, Paul, and that's as far as I got. He said, okay, I won't do it. He knew his thinking was off, and he was ready to respond to a friend who was not in the storm of emotion, which brings us to the second application. And we'll call it fight, flight, freeze. Be more than your chemicals. Fight, flight is an active defense response when you either physically run or you fight when you're in a perceived danger. Freeze is fight or flight on hold, where you're preparing for your next move or you're just frozen by a chemical response. This is not a conscious decision that you make, and you can't control it in the moment. People can get better at it, but you can't control it. Your body very, very quickly, when it feels threatened, releases adrenaline and cortisol into your blood, and your heart rate goes up. You breathe faster. Your eyes become more focused. Your spidey sense turns on. You know, your blood will even thicken, preparing you for an injury. Pain perception can be temporarily reduced. All this is triggered by the brain's response to fear. And we condition ourselves through experience to fear what we perceive of as threat. That's how God made our bodies. And all of us have trained ourselves, rightly or wrongly, to perceive of certain things as a threat. And when faced with that thing, our brain thinks we're in danger at different levels. If you've been through terrible trauma, it's a high level. That's PTSD is in that moment being back in the trauma, whether it was combat or whatever. What does this have to do with learning to love criticism or becoming wise? We are spiritual, physical hybrids. We live as eternal beings in earth suits. These earth suits are designed certain ways. This is one of the ways that they've been designed. So it's important to think about this. So as you're thinking about giving critique or receiving critique, remember that you're a hybrid. So maybe for good reason, a terrible experience in the past or abuse of parents, whatever, you've learned to see all criticism as a threat or a danger, and your brain registers it that way. Now when someone offers criticism, your autonomic system kicks in and responds with fight, flight, or freeze. You perceive it as a threat. So it'd be important as a spiritual physical hybrid to realize that's what's going on sometimes. Allow your body to respond. Realize there's no real threat here. And you can, over time, begin to retrain your brain, your body to respond differently. Memorize scriptures. Pray to become better at it. But realize there's a physical component that you can train differently for. Once the chemicals have run their course, go back and evaluate the critique. Admit your response may have been a reaction. I've seen people, friendships end over what was really a chemical response to criticism or difficulty. Something was said, this person's fight-flight kicks in, they respond negatively, this person takes it personally or too personally, and then they never come back together. That's so tragic. Come back together later and say, you know, I responded, here's why I think that happened. If you're the one offering criticism and your words are flooding somebody, you recognize it, stop. Give them some space. It doesn't even mean that what you're saying is wrong. It doesn't even mean how you're saying it's wrong necessarily. But you're not being helpful in that moment. Now, I'll talk more in just a minute about how not to be a jerk. But if you're offering someone loving criticism, it's important to recognize their initial response may not be great, and you shouldn't take it personally. Give them some grace, some space, and then re-engage. Just because you were flooded by somebody doesn't mean they were wrong or they were being a jerk for saying it. That being said, don't be a jerk. That's point number three. If you love to give criticism, please don't. You say, well, I'm really good at it. No, you're not. I was talking to a friend just in between services, and years ago, he was at a church working in their kitchen preparing some food, and a guy walked up and said, is the pastor around? And my friend, it was Kevin Nunes, goes, no. He goes, why? He goes, well, I have the gift of rebuke, and I want to go rebuke the pastor. And Kevin said, not a spiritual gift, sorry. And Kevin talked to him. Turns out, surprisingly, he hadn't been able to stay in a church very long, keep friends very long. Is that a shocking thing for you? So if you love people, don't hold back from offering criticism out of self-protection or fear of hurting someone's feelings. People who genuinely and are actively concerned with hurting people through their words, they don't want to do it, are less likely to actually do it. The person who's unconcerned with hurting people with their words, they're the ones who actually do harm. So if you're offering critique lovingly to a person who's a mocker, a fool, they're probably not going to take it well, but you probably shouldn't be offering it to them anyway. So here's a cue from Jesus on how not to be a jerk. It's from the Sermon on the Mount again. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye, then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now, the problem here is not removing specks from eyes. If you've ever had a speck in your eye, it doesn't feel like a speck. It feels like a board. A tree. I had a speck in my eye last week, and if someone could have helped me get it out, that would have been a gift to me. Speck removal is not the issue here. The issue is who's doing the speck removal. And it's a guy with a 2x4 in his eye. And he's trying to get the speck out. Clank, clank, clank. Stop. It's not helpful. And so Jesus is talking in this sermon, and when he says things like this, the people would have chuckled. And then they would go, wait a minute, is he talking about me? And so the idea is, this is a wise, loving, self-aware person who realizes they're not perfect, who know they have their own mess, their position to help people who have real issues, like specks in their eye. It's an illustration. You don't want to overapply it. The idea is not that you have to be speck-free, sin-free, to offer any critique. The idea is you have to be humble, self-aware. The plank eye person is a person who doesn't have any awareness that they have their own sin. So to avoid being a jerk, stay connected to Christ. Be humble. Don't be arrogant. Don't be superior. Don't demand that people heed your advice. If you give advice and then you're overly tied to it, you've made this about you. Give a critique as God leads you, but do it with an open hand, not a closed fist. Which brings us to application number 4. For this to happen effectively, you really want to build trust left of the bang. And you've heard this a lot this year, the bang concept. I'll give you a 5-second overview. The bang is a big event. Left of the bang is where you build resiliency. Right of the bang is where you respond and circle back around and build resiliency again. Here for today, we'll call the bang a situation where someone really needs critique. Someone needs counsel. You need it. A friend came to me last week making a major life decision. That was a sort of bang. It wasn't a trauma, but it was super important for how their life goes forward. And so when the big event, the bang, the time where you need counsel comes, it's often too late to go back and get the kind of trust you need with people for you to hear them well and for them to speak honestly to you. And so you want to be able to build trust now so that you're able to listen well and people are able to speak clearly to you in the middle of the bang. So we want to build trust relationships. How do we do that? I'll give you 2 things. Time and intentionality. We're all busy, or we're introverted, or we're self-protective, or we're proud, or we've had bad experiences, or some combination of all this. And so there's all these barriers in place to keep us from forming these kind of relationships that allow us to more easily give and receive this correction. So in order for it to happen, you have to have time plus intentionality. Time just needs to do its work. You just have to be around people and show up. But you have to mean for it to happen. People have said, well, I've been around here for years and don't have close friends. Time without intention is not enough. You've got to show up and then keep deciding to show up. That's the time part. But you've got to intend for it to happen, mean for it to happen. You say, well, this is the church. It ought to be easier to connect deeply with people. No, it shouldn't. Connecting deeply with people by default is not easy. It's too important and too powerful to be easy, but it's possible, and it's important. There are other factors besides time and intentionality to having this kind of connection. It's like being open, being humble, don't be a jerk, those kind of things. But for our point this morning, if you want to build these kind of relationships left of the bang, you got to show up, and you got to mean for it to happen. Last point. This is how we're organized as a church, organically, organizationally, to help make this happen. Small groups. Small groups are organized. We have specific qualifications and processes for how we select and train leaders and how we operate in group life. We've determined what we believe to be biblical and wise and helpful ways of doing group life. So there's an organizational structure to it, but they're also organic. They're highly relational. They work when we do the work of relationships. They're not magic. If you just show up and sit back and don't pour yourself in, nothing magic will happen. They work in the ways they're intended to work, meaning they will give back to you in proportion to what you're willing to give out to them. Brian, I knew Brian in those early days. Brian was brash, outspoken, direct, but he threw in. He threw in, and him and Karen grew very quickly. Groups are not designed to be times of deep intellectual study. They're focused on information, some biblical content, application, and relationship. And over time, that's what leads to transformation. Out of small group comes opportunities, if you want them, for one-to-one mentoring and other kinds of give-and-take relationships. If you want more precise and detailed information, I want theological training. I can tell you we have some classes here on Sunday night. You can come. I can load you up with books if you want. You buy them. I'll tell you which ones to buy. And you can even pay a lot of money to seminary if you want. They'll take your money. But we're after change. So we want a balance of information and application and community. That's how people's lives change. Groups are starting back. Some groups have been ongoing all summer. Some are starting back. There's some new ones starting up. Our college ministry challenge, there's about 125 students involved in small group. These are some encouraging numbers for me. About 80 of our high school and middle school students in small groups. So over 200 of the next generation are engaging wisdom and community. That's pretty encouraging. If you're not in a group, consider getting in one. If you've been in one and cycled out, consider getting back in one. If you want to video in, if you're out there videoing in right now, some groups will video you in. We can help you find out which ones. It will not be convenient. Unless you're my daughter, Corey, who always loves anything relational, everybody else I know, it's not convenient for them. Connecting with people deeply is rarely, if ever, convenient. But it's good. It's an opportunity to grow wise, to have battle buddies who can stand by you when you need them, and you stand by them when they need you. If you want help connecting to a group, go to our website. You can hit the group page, and it'll even have a little thing you can fill out. Or you can just hit that Jim button or that Brenda button and talk to them directly. Once a year, we have what we call Small Group Sunday. This is a modified version of that, where we give you a chance to hear from if you're not in groups and kind of know what we're about. It's a core of who we are as a church. If you're in a group already and you're plugging away, you know it's not magic. But you also know it's powerful and helpful. Let's pray together, then we're going to finish with some more worship.